You ever hear a story so wild you'd swear somebody made it up over a third cup of coffee? I'm Taildragger. This is The Hanger on Radio Hanger, and I promise you every word of what I'm about to tell you is true. A 19-year-old kid from West Germany flew a rented Cessna 172 right through the entire Soviet air defense network and landed next to the Kremlin, in Red Square, in 1987. Pull up a chair, this one's worth your time. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at aviationsoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. May 28, 1987. The Cold War is still very much alive. Ronald Reagan is in the White House. Mikhail Gorbachev is running the Soviet Union. And the Iron Curtain is the most heavily defended border on the face of the earth. We're not talking about a couple of radar stations and a polite request to turn around. We're talking about thousands of interceptor aircraft, surface-to-air missile batteries layered so deep they overlapped three times over, and a military that had literally shot down a Korean Airlines, Boeing 747, just 4 years earlier for straying into their airspace. 269 people dead. That was the world Matthias Russ decided to fly into. Who was this kid? He was a teenager from Wedel, a little town near Hamburg. He had about 50 hours in his logbook. 50. That's barely past solo cross-country territory for most of us. He didn't have an instrument rating. He didn't have any special navigation equipment. What he had was a rented Rheims Cessna 172P, registration DECJB, and what I can only describe as either the most extraordinary courage or the most breathtaking recklessness a teenager has ever shown. Maybe both. His cover story was a tour of Northern Europe. He'd been island hopping through Scandinavia. The Shetlands, the Faroe Islands, Iceland, Bergen, then Helsinki. Nice little trip. Nobody suspected a thing because it looked exactly like what a young European pilot with some money and free time would do. But Helsinki was where his real plan started. On the morning of May 28th, Rust took off from Helsinki-Malmi Airport. He filed a flight plan to Stockholm, perfectly normal. He headed west over the Gulf of Finland, and then somewhere over the water he turned off his transponder, dropped down low, and banked hard to the east, toward the Soviet Union. Now here's where it gets interesting. He wasn't flying blind. He had a basic roadmap, not an aeronautical chart with airways and frequencies and restricted areas, a roadmap. The kind you'd pick up at a gas station. He'd drawn a line from Helsinki to Moscow and figured he'd follow highways and railroads when he could see them. His total distance was about 750 miles. In a Cessna 172 with the fuel range to just barely make it if the winds cooperated, he crossed the Soviet coastline near the Estonian border at low altitude. And this is where the story gets almost impossible to believe because the Soviet air defense system absolutely detected him. They picked him up on radar almost immediately. The system was called Protovovoz Dushnaya Oborona, the National Air Defense Forces, and they were watching a pair of interceptors scrambled. Reports differ on whether they were MiG-23s or Su-15s, but either way, imagine the scene. You've got a Cessna 172 doing maybe 110 knots, puttering along at low altitude, and somewhere above and behind him, jet fighters are screaming through the sky trying to figure out what this contact is. They found him. They flew past him, and then things got complicated. See, just a few years earlier, the Soviets had been humiliated on the world stage for shooting down Korean Airlines Flight 007. The political fallout was enormous, so the rules of engagement had been tightened. The interceptor pilots could see it was a small civilian aircraft, they reported back. And the commanders on the ground hesitated. Nobody wanted to be the guy who ordered the shootdown of another civilian plane. Nobody wanted that on their record, on their conscience, or on the front page of Pravda. So they tracked him, and they waited for someone higher up the chain to make the call. And while they waited, Matthias Rust kept flying.
There was another factor working in his favor that day, and it was pure dumb luck. A Soviet border guard unit was conducting a training exercise in the area, and their radar operators had been given orders to ignore certain contacts that were part of the exercise. When Rust's blip appeared, some stations apparently classified him as part of the drill. His radar track got muddled up with the exercise traffic and partially lost in the system. He flew on, over Estonia, over Pskov, over the Russian countryside. For hours, a 19-year-old kid in a Cessna alone with a roadmap on his knee, and the entire Soviet military establishment arguing about what to do with him. Think about what that cockpit must have been like. The drone of that Lycoming 0320, the flat farmland of Western Russia unrolling beneath him. He's looking out the window, checking his map, trying to match railroad tracks and rivers to the lines he'd drawn with a pencil. No GPS, no moving map, no flight following. Just a compass, a watch, and a whole lot of nerve. He later said the fear came in waves. There were long stretches where the countryside was so empty and so quiet that he almost forgot where he was, and then he'd see a military airfield or a column of vehicles on a road, and his stomach would drop. He expected to be shot down at any moment. He expected to hear the roar of a jet fighter, and then nothing at all. But it never came. As the afternoon wore on, he began to see the outskirts of Moscow.
The city sprawled across the landscape, bigger than anything he'd seen from the air before. He started descending, looking for landmarks. He'd studied photographs. He knew what the Kremlin looked like. He knew what Red Square looked like, and he was going to land there.
Now let's talk about what landing in Red Square actually means from an aviator's perspective. Red Square is not an open field. It's a cobblestone plaza surrounded by the Kremlin walls, St. Basil's Cathedral with those onion domes, the State Historical Museum, and the Guillaume Department Store. It's roughly 800 meters long and 130 meters wide. For a Cessna 172, that's technically enough room. But there are light poles, there are wires, there are vehicles and pedestrians. And the surface is cobblestone, which is not exactly what Cessna had in mind when they published landing distance charts. Rust made his approach from the north, flying along the Moskva River. He circled the area once, twice, getting a look at the layout. People on the ground started pointing. Some thought it was a stunt, some thought it was a military exercise. Nobody in Moscow expected a little white airplane to come buzzing over the Kremlin. He initially considered landing directly in Red Square, but saw too many people. So he picked a spot on the Bolshoi-Masuretsky Bridge, a wide bridge just south of Red Square. He touched down on the bridge, rolled forward, and came to a stop near St. Basil's Cathedral, right there. In the shadow of the Kremlin walls, it was about 7 p.m. Moscow time. He'd been flying for more than 5 hours. He shut down the engine, climbed out, and started signing autographs. I'm not kidding. The crowd that gathered thought he was some kind of performer. He was wearing a bright red flight suit. He was young and smiling, and clearly not Russian. People were shaking his hand, taking pictures, for several minutes. It was more like a celebrity appearance than an international incident. Then the KGB showed up. Rust was arrested and taken away. The Cessna sat there on the bridge for hours before authorities figured out what to do with it. Photographs circulated around the world. The image of that little white Cessna parked next to St. Basil's Cathedral became one of the most iconic photographs of the Cold War era. It made the front page of every major newspaper on Earth.
The aftermath was seismic. And I mean that in the political sense. Gorbachev was furious, but he was also shrewd. He used the incident as a hammer. The Soviet military had just been publicly humiliated. A teenager in a Cessna had done what NATO war planners had spent decades trying to figure out, which was penetrate Soviet airspace and reach Moscow unscathed. Within days, Gorbachev fired his defense minister, Marshal Sergei Sokolov. He also removed the commander of the Soviet Air Defense Forces and hundreds of other officers. Some estimates say as many as 300 military officials lost their jobs. Gorbachev replaced them with reformers, people who would support his agenda of perestroika and glasnost. Some historians have argued that Rust's flight actually accelerated the end of the Cold War by giving Gorbachev the political cover he needed to clean house in the military establishment, which had been one of the biggest obstacles to reform, a kid in a Cessna, changing the course of world history. As for Rust himself, he was tried in Moscow and sentenced to 4 years in a labor colony. He served 14 months before being released in August of 1988 as a goodwill gesture. He went home to Germany and mostly faded from public life. His later years were troubled. There were legal problems that had nothing to do with aviation, but none of that changes what he did on that May afternoon. The Cessna itself had an interesting afterlife. The Soviets kept it for a while, and it eventually ended up in a German museum. It's been displayed in various locations over the years, that unassuming little 172 that beat the most formidable air defense system on the planet. Now I've been flying for a long time, and I've sat through a lot of hangar flying sessions where the stories get a little taller with each telling. But this one doesn't need any embellishment. The facts are wild enough. 50 hours total time, a roadmap, no instrument rating, 750 miles through hostile airspace, landing on a bridge next to the Kremlin.
Every time I pre-flight a 172, I think about this story. That airplane, the most common training aircraft in the world. The one we all learned in. The one we've all taken for granted. It crossed the Iron Curtain. It outran the Soviet air defense network. Not by being fast or stealthy or sophisticated, by being small and slow and confusing. By being so unlikely that nobody could quite believe it was happening until it had already happened. There's a lesson in there somewhere, and I'm not entirely sure it's a comfortable one, but it makes one heck of a hangar flying tale. I pulled this story from a few sources, mainly Don Berliner's account and the reporting in Der Spiegel from the months after the incident. Good stuff if you want to go deeper. You can find more stories like this one at radiohangar.com. I'm Taildragger, Blue Skies, and keep the shiny side up.